Chapter 1. It begins with the fire. Or maybe a few hours earlier, when I walk into town on a Saturday afternoon to buy, you know, girl products. I don't go shopping by myself too often. Usually I'm with one of the other girls from the home, Tony or Betty or my roommate, Katie, or Sarah sometimes. I follow along and they don't mind, even if I'm the one people notice. I'm the dark one, or the little darky, or the colored girl. I'm not saying there's anything especially special to know about me, but still, I have a name. People in town don't give a hoot about our names, or who our parents might have been other than dead. They feel sorry for us, because of the dead part. But otherwise, we're part of who they are. Like at Green's Bakery, when Mrs. Green puts an extra cookie in the bag and says real loud, "And here's another treat for good luck." So everyone in the store knows how generous she is. Or at the newsstand when Mr. Arnold saves last month's issues of Teen Screen magazine and tells other shoppers he keeps them specially for the orphans. We're not complaining. We like free cookies. And we love getting new pinups of the Beatles or Haley Mills or Elvis Presley. Sometimes when we go to town, we play a game called Poor Little Me. Whoever gets the most free stuff from shopkeepers wins. Then we divvy it all up and share everything. Which works in my favor because the darky doesn't win too often. I decided on my birthday 2 weeks ago, when I turned 16, that I'd be braver about things like going to town alone. Today is the test, since the other sevens are all busy. That's us, the oldest ones, with Sarah oldest of all. We're the seven. We've been here pretty much since we were born and grown up together like sisters. Today, while I've got the money, I want to stock up on girl stuff from Pitt's Drugs and Sundries. I don't like to request it from the matron because then she keeps asking, sometimes right in front of other people, "Everything all right with your monthly?" Better to be prepared. So I'm in line holding the box, plus Noxzema for my face, but there are two boys in front of me nudging each other, waiting to buy boy things, as it turns out, because they ask Mr. Pitt to get something from behind the counter. And that's what's making them red-faced and shifty-eyed. One of the boys, I know who he is. He's the one Sarah goes with. Cute, maybe, but mean. I take a quick look at the box Mr. Pitt gives him, wondering. I don't know exactly how those things work, but I know boys use them when they plan to touch girls all over and shoot minnows. Are those to use with Sarah? Does she do that with him? And suddenly he's knocking my arm. "What are you staring at, Blackie?" he says. Nothing. Face hot as heck. I'm not. Why do I say anything when he calls me that? Because they teach us at the home that it's rude not to answer when you're spoken to. "We'll have no rough talk in here," says Mr. Pitt, giving the boys their change. "Off you go now." The boys leave, and now it's my turn to avoid the druggist's eye. He slides my box and the blue Noxzema jar into a brown paper bag, so no one but him has to know that it's nearly my time of the month. Outside, though, the boys are waiting. And now it's four of them instead of two. Sarah's boy leans against the telephone pole, smirking at me, smoking a cigarette. "Get what you needed, Blackie," he says. "Aw, Luke," says one of his buddies. "Leave her alone." But Luke snatches the bag right out of my hand and tears it open. "What have we here?" He yanks out the box, drops the bag, and I hear a crack as the glass Noxzema jar hits the cement. "Blackie's got the curse." Luke waves the box like it's a trophy he just ran a race for, and the other boys cheer. He tosses the box to one of his pals, while I want to die 9 deaths right there on the sidewalk. Mr. Pitt opens the door and steps out, jabbing a broom into the air. "You scram, kids! I've told you before, no loitering on my premises." The boys laugh, but the game is over anyway. My box is dropped, and Luke moves in to step on it with his big shoe. "Oops," he says. I wait till they're gone to pick up the squished box and the bag with the broken glass and white cream soaking through. Mr. Pitt shakes his head.
"I'll take that," he says. "Straight into the bin. Come get yourself replacements. Half price."
If I skip the Noxzema, I'll have nearly enough. Mr. Pitt lets me promise the extra 14 cents next time I come to his store, which turns out to be never. Last year, the President of the United States was shot with a rifle, like a rabbit, and killed, with hundreds of people watching. Miss Webster told us the news, crying her eyes out. Then Mrs. Hazleton, also teary, gathered us sevens in the common room and told us again in a cracking voice. I don't think any of us understood why it mattered so much. None of us ever met him, and we're not even Americans, except for Jumpin' Joe, the cook. They turned on the television right then, in the middle of the day, for us to watch the news. "History unfolding," said Mrs. H. It made my insides feel like jello, watching grown-ups holding on to each other, wiping tears off their cheeks. Men, even, with ties on, weeping. We could see he was a man who had given people hope, and now that hope had been blown up with a gunshot. Later on, Joe told me that John Fitzgerald Kennedy Jr. was the first president to get in trouble for suggesting that coloreds should be treated equal to anybody else. He'd asked a question in one of his speeches, a question that Joe was pretty sure no white person answered. Who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place? In the home, it doesn't matter what color I am. I'm just Malou. Maybe I'm Blackie in the town, but that's just rude white boys like Luke calling me names. Who knows what happens anyplace else? I've only been here. The Benevolent Home for Necessitous Girls. That's where we live. Fancy words for something very simple. A place for girls with nowhere else to be. Bedtime. Getting the littles ready for bed is the seven's evening chore, which might sound easy, because what's so hard about watching a kid brush her teeth? Except there are 17 littles, and not all of them are friendly. They make me think of chipmunks, cute and chattery until you make them mad, and then boom, you're surrounded by rabid rodents who want to bite off your fingers. There used to be way more than 17, but the home is closing. The way Mrs. Hazleton explains it, the government is shutting us down because of a new philosophy that children should be raised in families, not in institutions. Maybe they should ask the children. I'm guessing most of us would say not just any family. To me, the seven are my sisters. Better than any family, except maybe the one that really belongs to me. And what are the chances of finding that? Luckily, tonight is not a bath night, so we only have to get the littles' faces washed, their nails scrubbed, and their teeth more or less rinsed. Miss Webster, our home ec teacher, stays in the house at night, on the first floor with the smallest girls. And Joe the cook, who nearly never stops humming, is in his room off the kitchen, of course. The routine is that after we've done the littles and possibly some math or school reading, most of us land in Tony and Betty's room. We complain about the teachers. Tony shows us dance moves. Sarah moans about Luke. If Tess has sneaked out, we look through her magazines. That kind of thing. If Miss Webster forgets about us or can't be bothered to climb the stairs, we might play a game, like Truth or Dare. Answer a question truthfully or else accept a dare. Some of us find it harder to tell the truth than we do to perform weird or silly feats of daring. Living in a house with a lot of girls, you learn to protect yourself by not always saying what's in your heart. It comes out often enough by accident, especially if we skip truth or dare and go straight to our favorite pastime. Who am I? All orphans wonder who their parents might be. It's something we talk about without end. We pretend to listen to each other, but really, it's an excuse to color the pictures in our own heads. "I've been thinking," Betty might begin, "that my father is a duke or a viscount instead of a prince. A prince gets watched too much, but one of the lesser royals, a cousin maybe, could sneak off and have a baby, right?" Betty is stuck on the idea that one of her parents is royalty, so we play along, even though, hello, how would she end up in Ontario if she were the daughter of even the most minor duke of the most minor monarchy? Tess claims that she, Tess, is an alien waiting for the mothership to come and rescue her from Earth. This seems way more likely than Betty's scenario. Dot changes her mind every week about which celebrities might be her parents. She thinks we don't know that she writes to them on her Christmas stationery. If she ever actually sent one, what would someone like, for instance, Frankie Valli think? How about, "What a weirdo"? He'd toss it straight into the waste paper basket, and all her dreaming would end up crumpled into a ball of pink paper. In my fantasy, my family isn't fancy or famous, and I'm not clear about what they look like, other than brown, and it doesn't matter what they do for their jobs. Teachers? Or maybe they own a pet store. What I think about is sitting with them at a kitchen table, or in cozy chairs beside a fireplace, playing cards. Sitting in the back of the car, going on vacation to a sunny place with water splashing against a sandy shore. What I never say out loud during "Who am I?" is that I secretly imagine that someone is keeping an eye on me, the way that Ram Dass does for Sarah Crewe in A Little Princess, bringing her delicious food through the attic window and lighting a fire in the grate, making her feel as if she is looked after, even though her father is gone. Or in Anne of Green Gables, when dear old Matthew Cuthbert goes to buy a dress for Anne, insisting on puffed sleeves because he cares enough to fulfill her heart's desire. Wouldn't that be the most amazing thing? First, having a heart's desire, and then having it fulfilled. I don't know who my parents were. I hope they loved me. But mostly, I wonder how they died. How parents die. Orphans are very popular literary characters, and I've read every story about motherless waifs that I could get my hands on. It began when I was 9 and found a book in the library called Heidi's Years of Wandering and Learning. Heidi became an orphan when she was 1 year old. Her aunt Diet — there are lots of aunts in stories about orphans, mostly mean ones — eventually takes Heidi to live with Heidi's grouchy old grandfather in a hut on a mountain. Being a little ball of sunshine, Heidi makes friends with everyone she meets, including the miserable grandpa. That started a literary obsession for me, and our matron, Mrs. Hazelton, let me read and read. Whenever a new story was published that featured a child facing the world without parents, it appeared in the home's library. I read them all. I wanted to know, how did this happen to me? I keep a list of how parents in books die. Sarah Crewe's father died of a brain fever. Jane Eyre's father died of typhus. We know he was a good man because he caught the illness while caring for poor people. Tarzan's father was killed by Kerchak, king of the very same ape tribe that turned around and raised little orphan Tarzan, teaching him to swing from vines and holler like a monkey. James explored the insides of a giant peach after both his parents were killed by a stampeding rhinoceros. See? The mothers often die during childbirth, while the fathers get ill or have an accident. But no author will ever run out of ideas for getting rid of parents. My favorite position for sleeping. In our own room, Katie and I like to whisper in the dark. Tonight I tell her what happened with Sarah's boyfriend, because I trust her not to tell anyone else, especially Sarah. Katie says he's a scumball and should be forced to lick a toilet bowl. I haven't been able to shake the shakes since it happened. I don't bother with my own teeth, after making 17 littles do theirs. No face washing, no hair picking, no nothing. I sprinkle baby powder on the sheet and rub it around to make everything smell good. Sometimes I wake up and half of my face is powdered white, and the girls tease me, like I'm trying to be white. I've told them, whether they believe it or not, that I happen to like my color best. Dark honey or nutmeg or coffee with milk. Whatever food-related description you want to come up with. It's better than oatmeal or white bread or boiled potato. In bed, on my stomach, I push my head into the soft, dark place under the pillow. A noise wakes me. Shouting. Scared shouting. Not a dream. In 1 second, I go from the vast, dim world of underpillow to standing up on the small wool mat beside my bed, staring at the heating vent set into the wooden flooring. Smoke is curling upward in thickening wisps. More shouting outside and banging noises. Katie! I poke her and jam my feet into sneakers. Fire! Betty is yelling in the hall. Wake up! We're on fire! Holy crap, says Katie. She's up too, turns back to grab her watch and opens the door. Smoke pours in, a nasty cloud that chokes my next breath. This is for real, even without flames. We've had a million drills. We know what we're supposed to do, but I can't see anything. It smells bad. I can't breathe. The drills were never like this. Joe's gritty voice calls from below. He's clanging saucepan lids, an eerie ringing in the fog. My eyes sting and I crouch to crawl on the floor where the air is not so smoky. Only my nightie bunches under my knees, so I have to stand back up. Girl shapes collide as we push to the top of the stairs. Me and Katie, Betty and Tony, Dot and Sarah. We're all trying to squeeze down at the same time, but we keep bumping into each other, whimpering. Scared as heck. Someone asks, "Where's Tess?" "Already out," says Dot. Next floor down, I move blindly along the corridor with Katie and Dot right behind, all of us croaking in alarm, banging on the doors. Joe is with us for a moment, helping to herd some of the littles toward the stairs.
"Ms. Webster went down already with the first batch," he says. "Go along now. We'll meet you at the bottom."
He goes with Tony and Betty down the stairs, marching the rest of the smaller girls as fast as they can stumble. It's impossible to see and hard to suck in breath. I trip on the steps, clutch for the railing, and claw someone's hair instead. The kids are bawling, terrified, making me smarten up and calm down. "It's okay, Lindy. We've got you, Kathy. Just hold on, Marjorie. Hold on. You can do it, Lindy. Keep going." Katie and Dot are murmuring too, practically carrying Harriet and Fiona. It's hot and terribly dark in the stairwell, but a stripe of light appears below and I choke out a sob of relief. "Hurry now, hurry!" Miss Webster is waiting with the front door open. She scoops Fiona out of Katie's arms and limps over the stoop, leading us into the yard. The air outside is still smoky as heck, but so much fresher than where we've been that it seems as though I'm drinking it. "Keep moving. Go along. Hurry now." Miss Webster prods us farther along and away from the home. We keep pushing the littles, who are mostly shivering, in shock, and a couple are howling. Heat blows over us in gusts. I can taste the smoke and feel the grit under my eyelids when I blink. We get to the fence that borders the road and stop to turn around. The home. It's an enormous old house, sitting in fields with a sparse little woods behind. There's a road with a ditch and an ordinary fence, a few ordinary elm trees, fields growing ordinary crops. Follow the road to the nothing town, full of more brown brick buildings with dim windows. That's the scenery we know. We stand in a clump, watching it turn spectacular. The flames catch hold and jump to the sky. They rip a bright hole out of the dark, like a wound bleeding out of control. This fire, for a whole minute, is majestic. The way a thunderstorm or a sunset can make your body tingle with surprise and awe. It's the sound that unnerves me. A hollow roar as if someone very sick were trying to breathe in long, shuddering tremors. Then the windows start to pop, so loudly it's like pistol shots. Tony shrieks and grabs her head with her hands. For a second, we all think she has somehow been hurt. But the next second, she's running across the field, making a dreadful howl. Betty says, "Just let her go." There goes the library, a deafening crackle as the hungry fire eats up thousands of pages, taking all the words in a greedy feast of paper. Our rooms at the top fall in an avalanche of glowing timbers. The sinks from the blue door bathroom are spat into mid-air like gumballs. The kitchen is crushed. The dining hall, all those shelves of chunky china. Does china burn? Or turn to ash? A million shards of a million mealtimes are crushed under the bones of the house. Someone is tugging on my arm. "Malou, come on! Malou!" Dot's face is smudged black. Can I be even blacker? I blink my stinging eyes and look around. All the girls are singed and weary. Katie and Miss Webster carry a sobbing Kathy toward the home's van. "We're supposed to go too," Dot's telling me. "They're waiting." Three or four more cars have come from town. Men and women race over the grass, rounding up wandering children, hustling them toward blankets and cars. Finally, the hee-haw of a siren rips up the drive as the firemen arrive, pushing my heart into my throat and slamming my ears. Big men with black coats and enormous boots stomp across the grass. One guy waves a stick that's been painted with something that makes it glow in the dark. "Move back! Move back!" The blackened frame of the house is silhouetted against roaring flames, a skeleton in dancing light. I remember a picture. On the television in Joe's room last fall, I saw a news story about a burned-up church in Alabama. Four little Negro girls died when a bomb went off at their Sunday school. The bomber was someone who hated Negroes. The segregation of whites and coloreds in the United States was maybe coming to an end. The bomb was a protest against having Negroes mingle up close with white-skinned people. We are not encouraged, in the home, to be curious about the news. We're meant to be safe here, like boats in a harbor, not concerned with the waves that rock the sea. But Joe, he's got a little television in his room. And Joe, he's from New Orleans, where he says every second person is brown like me. He says, "There'll be a day when I'll have some of those people in my own life." He says that being a Negro is not about not being white. It's about being who I am, even if that doesn't make sense yet. He says, "I need to know that." Joe used to be a musician before he came to Canada. He played the guitar in bars all over the southern United States. He says he has lots of friends who are dark-skinned like me. He even had a sweetheart, he says, as dark as plum pudding. Her name was Asha. So when news happens about Negroes, he invites me to come and watch, especially stuff about fighting for what's fair. At the home, I never have to fight. The girls and teachers know me here, so there's no bother. In the town, though, like with Luke and those other boys today, I get stared at with suspicious, slitty eyes. Not orphan staring. Negro orphan staring. Is it something more than just rude? Does somebody hate me as much as the bomber hated those four little girls in Alabama? Is this fire somehow because of me? The darkie? The van. Joe climbs into the driver's seat while we load in every little we can get our hands on. Marjorie is clinging around Miss Webster's neck like a boa constrictor, practically choking her. It takes a few minutes to peel her off. I hear singing, says Katie. So do I. It's faint, because the fire is still roaring, but we recognize Mrs. Hazleton's voice, trembling a little, offering up amazing grace, the way she does sometimes at assemblies. Get in, says Miss Webster. Her eyes are pink-rimmed, her hair sticking out in all directions. Her room is gone, too. One more glance at the burning home, and we squish in with the other girls. The smell in the van is like a fireplace when the logs are damp, when they smolder instead of burn.